Our guest, Roger Waters, was a founding member of the most important rock band of the progressive era, Pink Floyd, a band that recently reunited for a performance at the Live Aid concert in London. We'll hear today how a phone call from our guest, Roger Waters, to bandmate David Gilmour, their first communication in 20 years, precipitated that event. But first, we'll hear about Waters' new endeavor, an opera, Ça Ira, or It Will Be in English, about the French Revolution. The opera has been recorded on Sony Classical and is out now. I began our conversation asking Waters about the origins of the work for him.
Friends of mine from Paris, a couple, Etienne and Nadine Rodagil, came to me in 1989 with a beautiful 50-page manuscript which Etienne had written this text, and his wife Nadine was an artist and she'd illustrated every page of it. It's a sort of poetic and polemical history of the French Revolution, which characterizes human beings as birds, and I won't try and describe it all, but I was very struck with it. And they asked me if I would be prepared to set it to music. And I was intrigued by that idea, and I worked for a sort of 30 days non-stop, and I ended up with a 2.5-hour long demo. This demo on cassette was taken back to Paris and eventually found its way to François Mitterrand, the president of the Republic, who listened to it and liked it and suggested it should be part of their bicentennial celebration. And there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and politics about that. In the end, it didn't become that, which is probably a very good thing, because the idea that I could have lashed it into some sort of shape so that it could be performed in the 6 months that I would have had between when he listened to it and July the 14th, 1989, it would have been an absurd task to tackle. And then, sadly, Nadine Rodagil died the next year of leukemia, and so we did nothing, Etienne and I, for another 6 years. And then in 1995, I got my notes and things off the shelf, and Etienne and I talked, and we decided to continue with the project. And then eventually I approached Sony Classical, and they liked the work I'd done so far, and so I did a deal with them. And then they prevailed upon me to translate the whole thing into English, which I did, kicking and screaming, but I finally did it. And I wrote some new bits and some prologues to some of the scenes. And it's now a finished record, and there will be a concert performances in Rome in November of this year, and hopefully some concert performances in the United States. We're in negotiations with half a dozen different cities, opera houses or symphonies, who might be interested in doing this in the spring next year. I think slightly depending on how well it goes in Rome.
Are you kind of shocked that it's gotten to this point? And it's interesting hearing you describe how sort of the politics of the classical world, in some ways you've gone around that by approaching the recording entity kind of first with it and then let it go out from there.
Well, you know, I expect the knives to come out, and they already have to some extent, though I've had a couple of quite good reviews, or in fact a couple of ecstatic reviews in England. But the way I circumvented the establishment was by paying for it, you know. And so it's rather – so I'm expecting, you know, to be vilified. And not least because the piece is unashamedly rooted in an early 19th century tradition. I'm not trying to do anything new or, you know, or my tastes in opera and in classical music are not modern. When I'm listening to classical music, I want my relationship with it to be emotional. I want to be moved by it. I have no intellectual interest in music of any kind, really. Not in rock and roll or in classical music.
If I've used that adjective sprawling, I could also use that to the history of the French Revolution. And what did you pick and how did you center the story to make it have personal resonance? Or I guess how did, Rodagil do that?
Well, you could say both things if you wanted to. In order to describe to you how he did it, I would have to start spouting in French, which probably wouldn't help anybody very much, except to say that Etienne saw lessons in the early days of the revolution for us today, political lessons and lessons in how we might become more humane. And I think, you know, Etienne was and still is very attached to the Déclaration des droits de l'homme and what's embodied in it, because this is 200 years ago now, and as we know, before then and before the Declaration of Independence here and before the writing of the American Constitution, the idea that individual human beings have rights that we can identify didn't exist. Nobody thought of that, really. It's a relatively new concept, and one with which we're all still grappling. I found in the bits that I wrote after I'd done the English translation, where I added to the narrative, I wanted to find the humanity in all the protagonists of that particular histoire, and in consequence, I've looked at the more humane aspects of and the tragedy of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, rather than just making them the villains of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Which they weren't. I mean, Louis XVI was not very bright and not very strong, but he was also not very evil. You know, if you read the letters and see what he did, he was just a bit confused. It all got a bit too much for him, really. Labouring as he was under the burden of having been told since he was a tiny child that he was directly connected to God and that he had this divine power and divine rights, which would be a huge burden for any human being to shoulder, I would suggest.
We're talking with Roger Waters of Pink Floyd and of the composer of Ça Ira, a new opera based on the French Revolution. You mentioned Marie Antoinette, and there is a there's a little piece in the first scene that she kind of appears in an unlikely situation, which is, I suppose, your invention. But there's a kind of a cute little duet. Maybe you could set this up and we could play it.
Yeah, okay. Well, strangely, that's one of the pieces that I appended to the beginning. When, having translated the French, I felt a need to enhance the narrative flow of the piece. I desperately needed a beginning, so I put two of the protagonists in a garden in Vienna when they're both young. One is the tenor, who's the main character in the piece, who's a revolutionary priest as a child, and the other is Marie Antoinette as a young girl. As you will hear, they have a conversation where she says, "You can't understand my life because it's above and beyond your aspirations." And he's saying, "Prenez garde, outside the wall here, things are not well and the people are starving and there's going to be trouble.
One day I'll be queen, live on peaches and cream, wear satin and lace, and laugh in the faces of the teachers. The boys will all fawn before me like beasts. La-la-la.
There's a duet that appears early on in the first act of Roger Waters' Ça Ira, and we're having a chance to hear some of this music and talk about the making of this piece. You know, when you think back to your solo work, the work with Pink Floyd, orchestration is such a part of that, but it's a different kind of orchestration. And was this a challenge to you? And explain maybe a little bit about how the orchestration came about. Obviously, computers are involved.
Well, let me go back to the beginning. The demo that I made was a sort of an oral demonstration of what the orchestrations might sound like. And so what we did was we got students from the Royal Academy to do some of the legwork and to listen to my demos and write it all out, write out everything that they could hear on the demo and manuscript. That was our starting point. And then we started to work using a computer program. At the time, it was a program called Notator.
Did the biggest thrill come in hearing it with the orchestra in the studio or hearing the finished thing put together?
Well, first of all, the MIDI, the stage two, which is the MIDI version, mm-hmm. having I would like write something and orchestrate it and play it, and I would when I was adding sort of arias quite late on in the process, and I would often then pick up the phone and call Rick and say, "Hey, Rick, listen to this. I just did this, the last couple of days." And he'd go, "Oh, that's beautiful, And I say, "Yeah, but did I write it?" Because I was never quite sure whether it was derivative or not, There are only 12 notes, and they only can go in a certain number of orders. So to organize them in a way that sounds like a melody, and it's interesting to me what that process is and how did that Irish person, wherever they were on that street, 100 years ago, write Danny Boy? And who... then somebody heard it and wrote it down and it's a strange thing where melodies come from, given that there are only sort of 12 notes in a scale. But back to the process, the moment when the orchestra makes that first chord takes your breath away. Well, it took my breath away. To be in a room in the middle of an orchestra, a big orchestra like that, is a fantastic experience. I love it.
Let's play a bit from the actually very beginning, there's liberal use of sound effects on this as well as it moves into the overture and we get a chance to hear the orchestra for the first time in Sa-ira. Roger Waters is our guest, and that is a bit of the beginning of Sa-ira. Yeah, Roger, I would have to say some of the themes of the French Revolution of this opera are not terribly different from themes that we might have heard in some of your work in the past. And I was just curious as to what the origin of your political life is, political beliefs, if you can pin them down.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's any kind of secret. My mother... when I was growing up, which I did in Cambridge, university town in England, my mother was deeply involved politically. She was a Communist Party member until 56, or was it 55? Until Hungary, anyway, when she, like most right-thinking members of the British Communist Party, left the party because the party refused to condemn the Russian invasion of of Hungary. But so my young childhood was very much taken up with daily worker bazaars, and then after that, our the front room in our house was always used as a Labour Party committee rooms during all general elections and local elections and so on and so forth. My mother used to take my brother and I, when we were young children, if there wasn't anybody to look after us at home, so we would, you know, spend evenings at the British China Friendship Association watching kind of grainy black and white movies of the People's Republic's heroic struggle against the Japanese and the puppet government and so on and so forth. So all of that got very, very locked into my mind. But those meetings would routinely be held in the Friends Meeting House. In fact, I remember my mother, who was an atheist, she would always prevail upon me to understand that the Quakers, for instance, she had an awful lot of time for, because they operated at the humanistic, genuinely Christian end of the whole Christian thing, whereas we know there are a lot of people who operate at some other weird end of it that seems to have nothing to do with the teachings of Christ or generosity or humanity or, mm-hmm. or you know, turning the other cheek or loving thine enemy or any of that. Your president would be a good example of that.
Well, I was going to ask, because the gestation period of this whole thing is so long, from when Etienne Rodagil began it, what would have been in the 80s on through its final gestation in 2004, there's a lot of political things happening. Did you try to take that into account, or was it just inevitable that it would have some ring to what's going on today?
You know, Etienne, the last page of the libretto says... it starts off, si nous ne sommes pas pris dans la misère de luxe, dans l'envie des autres. And anyway, to translate it, if we are not trapped in the misery of luxury, in envy of the powerful, in respect for the strong, in dans les certitudes, you know, we so often fall into that trap of being certain that we know about things, being certain that we're right about things. We adopt, I've done this in my own life, and I understand what a trap it is. We adopt some position which quickly coalesces into a dogma, and we become entrenched, and reason, sweet reason, flies out of the window. He also says, dans le rêve solitaire, in the solitary dream, if we can surmount all those obstacles, ça ira, we may proceed to a future where we're more humane to each other, and where the empathetic possibilities of the human spirit are given a more healthy crack of the whip and freer rein. And that if that happens, that is the source of human joy. That is where pleasure and comes from. That's basically what Etienne was saying, and I have to say, I'm very sympathetic to that view. In fact, I would say that that's my view too. You may say that I'm a dreamer, mm-hmm. as John Lennon famously said. And of course, people, you know, cynics can always level criticisms at any kind of broad notions that one might have, that the human condition provides one with a stage for making choices. You know, I say at a certain point in the opera, and this is something that I wrote and that Etienne then translated into anything, I say... as ever, but it goes, it's sort of vaguely Shakespearean, and there's a joke at the beginning, because I use the words, but soft, you know, which is, what is it? But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? Mm-hmm. But soft, as ever in the ebb and flow, sweet reason, deft and incorrupt, adoring of the humankind, illuminates man's plight. Should he embrace the brute and base, tilt blindly at the carousel, or note at least that other voice, and entertain the choice between the darkness and the light? So I'm giving the ringmaster, the storyteller, lines there which ask the fundamental question that I think this piece, and I think all of my work really has been about, which is it realistic for individual human beings to try and identify the difference between good and evil, and having made that identification, to exercise the will to nudge not just oneself but the world in some small way towards the light and away from the darkness. I believe that's what's exciting about being alive. Otherwise, we might just as well, you know, otherwise we're just flotsam. And I don't believe that. In the face of all the bullshit that's going on in the world today, I see us, you know, the spark of the possibility that reason may prevail in the end. If it didn't, you know, if I didn't have that belief, I might just as well shoot myself.
So, therefore, one can obviously assume that Pink Floyd's decision to become part of the Live Aid concert was far more a political decision than any kind of a career decision.
Hello, is there anybody in there?
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah. It was a great thing for us to do. It was a great thing for me to do. I mean, Dave didn't want to do it. Bob Geldof asked Dave to do it, and he said no. And eventually, you know, after a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, I called Dave, and we hadn't spoken for 20 years, and so he was a bit surprised when he answered the phone and it was me. I got his numbers from Bob Geldof and said, hey, come on, let's do it. And he ummed and ahed a bit, and about a day later he called back and he said, yeah, all right. And we did it, and I think it was great. It was great to be on stage with those three guys again. It felt really good. The songs sounded good.
There is no
but also, particularly for Dave and I think, you know, we were able to act like grown-ups for a bit. I've felt over the last 20 years a bit kind of hypocritical about my entrenched extreme position in terms of what happened when I left Pink Floyd and all the mudslinging that went on. You know, although Dave and I will probably always have differing points of view about things, it was important for me to let bygones be bygones and say, hey, we did some pretty good work together, and let's play a few of these songs for this very good cause.
The grown-up Roger Waters.
Well, yeah. You know, you got to admit. You know, the other thing that's interesting about all of that, and I think this is fascinating, is that in the intervening 20 years, neurologists have done all the work. So we now know that our memories are absolutely not to be trusted, that the human brain will invent memories that are convenient to the ego. And we can believe them and be convinced that they are true and real memories, but we now know that the brain will invent them. And we have no way of knowing whether what we remember is real or is a construct to make us feel better about ourselves. You know, there's something very comforting about that. It can allow you to retreat from an entrenched position. You go, well, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it didn't happen like that. Maybe that's not truth.
Wow.
I like that.
I'm loving that, too. That allows for a lot of change in the world, which is obviously a lot of what needs to go on. Thank you so much for the work, for Saira and all the work over the years. And thanks so much for talking with us, too. Roger Waters, our guest.
Hey, David. Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment here on The World Cafe. Major thanks to Roger Waters for talking with us. That opera, Sa Ira, is available from Sony Classical Recordings and is available at our World Cafe CD store on your web browser at worldcafecds.com.